For those of you who are just joining us, I'm going to continue just for 20 seconds or so the discussion I was having with Jim Duff before the news break. This is a really troubling story here in Montreal. Not a huge story, but it's troubling in its implications. The idea that JPPS, Jewish People's Imperial Schools, is going to be taking off the name, the word Jewish, from its building after the renovations and just keeping the initials. In a letter that Jim read on the air that was received, apparently is being done because, quote, the situation in Israel. You know, we've been talking so often, particularly this week, about what was wrong with the liberal MPs who called for talks with Hezbollah. We don't talk to people that compromise our values. We don't talk with people whose position is what's mine is mine, which is negotiable. We don't talk with hate. We also don't give in to hate. Security is not the primordial issue. Character has to be the primordial issue. And too much in Canada today is based on security. Too much of our individual consequences given up for security. Not just on this kind of issue that's local. We tend to scream a lot about what happens in the Middle East. As we use it as a moral resort area. But we turn a blind eye to bigger problems, to real atrocities, to nations that are tyrannies for the sake of a dollar, for the sake of security. When China Minmetall is a state agency of the Chinese government, at the Central Committee of the Communist Party, was trying to buy Inco and Falconbridge. They openly said they were going to transfer processing jobs out of this country. They openly said that they wanted materials, resources for the military machine. And thankfully, the outcry that accompanied China Minmetall's purchase helped arrest that move by China. We stopped for a little while helping that machine, but so many of our jobs are being sent to China. So much of our treasure is being financed by taxpayer dollars just to get cheap slave markets, to produce cheaper goods. It's a rush to the bottom line, but it's also a rush to the bottom of our lives. And it's got to be fought with vigor, and it's got to be fought with resolve. It's a question of character. And our first guest tonight is international human rights lawyer David Mattis, joining us from Winnipeg. And we're privileged to have him with us today. He and former MP David Kilgore have just finished an extensive study of what China does inside and how it treats its minorities, how it treats political dissidents, and particularly the odious and sinister and cynical treatment of the Falun Gong, who are not only killed, but whose organs are harvested. This is an atrocity that is not getting enough coverage and enough attention in the world. And we owe great debt to David Mattis and David Kilgore for bringing it to our attention. And David Mattis, welcome, and thanks for taking time to be with us tonight.
Thank you for inviting me.
The title of a recent article you wrote, China's Bloody Harvest, says it all, not just about the Falun Gong and the organ harvesting they are involved in, but about their treatment generally of political dissidents and minorities. How much information were you and David Kilgore able to collect on what's going on in China?
Well, we're still collecting it, and I would say quite a lot. I mean, we got information from websites, information from people who had been in detention there and then escaped or were released. We had telephone callers calling throughout China, so we were able to get a fair amount of information.
The conclusions that you drew were pretty serious. I mean, you knew about the number, the amounts of money being paid for everything from corneas to liver and kidney combinations. Did you get an idea of how many people were being killed? We know numbers from various organizations that China routinely executes something like 20,000 political prisoners every year. But what has there any idea of the numbers of Falun Gong that are persecuted?
Well, the number we had in our report was between 2000 and 2005. There was 41,500 organ transplants that we couldn't source to any other place than Falun Gong practitioners. Now, one person can be the source of more than one organ, so that doesn't mean that 41,500 practitioners were killed, but it would have been in the tens of thousands.
Remarkable numbers, and we hear so little outcry from Human Rights Watch or Amnesty on this, and I want to ask you about those organizations when we come back right after this short break. The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. said, "Your life begins to end the day you stop caring about things that really matter." And we're privileged to have with us international human rights lawyer David Mattis, who with former Liberal MP David Kilgore has done an extensive study of China's genocidal, one could call it, but certainly odious and atrocious murders of the Falun Gong and the organ harvesting that's gone on. And David Mattis, you've just told us that the numbers are could be in the tens of thousands. Now, what I'd like to know is you've got a tremendous background in both international human rights work, civil liberties work here at home. Where is the outrage from the Amnesty Internationals, the human rights communities? Where is their cosmic sense of injustice? Why don't we hear more about this when it comes to places like China?
Part of the problem is that they, because they are big organizations, they've got kind of bureaucratic or standardized protocols and methodologies, which have difficulty coming to grips with an allegation like this. For instance, Amnesty International normally will not claim a violation has occurred unless there's two independent witnesses, both of whom tell them the same thing. But when it comes to this sort of allegation, where you're dealing with an operation where you've got a victim who dies and the body's cremated and there's no autopsy, a perpetrator who's guilty of crimes against humanity, unlikely to confess, a patient who knows nothing, and no witnesses, it doesn't really fit into that methodology. And in fact, for the purposes of our report, we had to devise a methodology to come to be able to come to the conclusions that we did. And part of the reason I took on this job, or I guess part of the reason I was asked, is that these more traditional organizations aren't really that well equipped to come to grips with an allegation like this, and as a result.
Well, you're being very kind when you talk about methodology, but AI and HRW have been around a while, and you know AI certainly didn't lose any time doing a one-sided report on the Middle East war that just terminated, saying that Israel's response was disproportionate, even using words like war crimes. And then when they were asked, well, what about the Israeli side of the story, they said, well, that they're going to look at later. So they don't seem to have problems there. You and David Kilgore did this investigation under the aegis of the Coalition to Investigate the Persecution of the Falun Gong in China. They seem to be able to respond quickly.
Yes.
In other words, is it satisfactory merely to say that, well, these organizations, they've done some good in the past, but they're bureaucratic, so we have to forgive them?
No. I think our methodology makes sense, and I would encourage them to adopt it. I certainly don't approve of what they're doing in the Middle East, but, the fact that they're bad in the Middle East doesn't suggest they use this. I wouldn't argue they use the same slipshod methods that they've used against Israel and apply them to China. Quite the contrary. I mean, I think they should be as careful with Israel as they have been with China. I have been in touch with both of them, and they are investigating this, and we are providing them materials, and I'm still hopeful that they'll come to grips with this. I haven't written them off.
You describe a very interesting way that you would try and get a confirmation of what was going on, among which you had callers phoning hospitals throughout China posing as family members of persons who needed organ transplants. How did that work?
Well, that was very simple. The callers were native speaking, Mandarin speakers, so it wasn't that difficult. We have, by the way, tapes, recordings and transcripts, if people are skeptical about these calls, it's possible to check them. But they just pretended basically to be customers, making some inquiries, and the reason they were interested in Falun Gong was supposedly because the Falun Gong have an exercise regime, they're going to be healthy and therefore a viable source for organs. And that was the basis in which the conversations developed.
You found out in your investigation that Falun Gong practitioners in prison are systematically blood tested and physically examined, yet because they're also systematically tortured, there's no motivation but concerns over their health. What are they tortured about? What does China think that they know, or what is the existential threat that they think they represent?
The reason they're tortured is the Chinese government wants them to renounce their adherence to Falun Gong. It's not to get any information out of them. It's to get them to change their beliefs. Now, what is the threat of the Falun Gong? Well, I mean, objectively, nothing. I mean, they have no political program. They don't want to take over the government. And it just seems like nutty, totalitarian paranoia. But I guess you could say that the Falun Gong, I mean, even though they're not political in any way, they're indigenous. They're based on Qigong or religious. They're a combination of two Chinese traditions. The exercise tradition, Tai Chi, I guess, is the most famous, mm-hmm. but there are many others. And the kind of spiritual tradition of Confucianism or Taoism, which are kind of blended together in Falun Gong, the result of which is they're very appealing to the Chinese population. And in fact, before they were shut down, they had a larger adherence than the Communist Party of China. Communism, of course, is not historically Chinese. It's historically Western. So what you've got is kind of an ideological movement which was more popular than the Communist Party of China, more indigenous than the Communist Party of China. And the Communist Party felt ideologically threatened, even though this other group had no political platform whatsoever.
So this group is, you know, we had, last week we had Gloria Nafziger of Amnesty International from Toronto on discussing the case of Hussein Salil, who's this an activist in the West. Many people may not know, but there are 7 million Muslims in China.
Uyghurs, yeah.
An ethnic group. They're not just a religious group, but ethnic, an ethnic group. So the Falun Gong don't represent. They're not demanding a separate state like the people.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. They're not demanding
anything. China will react the same way to whether it's an existential threat politically or whether it's an existential threat ideologically.
Well, in fact, the Falun Gong are treated far worse than the Uyghurs or the Tibetans or the democracy activists. The Falun Gong are enemy number one. I mean, organ harvesting, as far as we know, happens only with the Falun Gong and not with the Uyghurs or any of these other groups.
Is this simply business? Because they're healthier? Because of their regime?
No. It's also because they are more marginalized, more depersonalized, more dehumanized than any of the other groups. I mean, with the other groups, they're seen as some sort of political threat. But if you look at the language that the government of China uses towards the Falun Gong, it knows no bounds. I mean, they call it an evil cult. It goes on and on like this.
Words seem to matter to China almost as much as bullets. David Mattis, thanks for taking the time to be with us, and thank you for remembering to care about what matters.
You're welcome.
Montreal, we'll be right back. And you can email at us at info@iapm.ca. We just finished talking to international human rights lawyer David Mattis on the systematic murder, torture, and organ harvesting of Falun Gong followers in China. And he's released an extraordinarily damning report together with former Liberal MP David Kilgore. We were talking about where are all the human rights groups? Where is the cosmic sense of injustice? Where are the rallies when it comes to the Chinas and the Cubas and all these countries whose seem to be given a carte blanche right to be wrong by all these wonderful, caring, feeling human rights groups? David Mattis was talking about the methodology that made it difficult for them. He wasn't apologizing for them in any way. I think it's worse than that. I think there's a bias built in on these groups, into these groups. And one of the most odious examples of that came out again just this week when Amnesty International decided to weigh in on the Mideast crisis and, of course, condemned, as they usually do. Israel's use of force is disproportionate. Da-da-da-da-da, you can imagine the rest. We'll fill in the blanks in a moment. And when AI was asked, well, when are you going to hear Israel's side? They said, well, that's for another report. We're going to do our own debunking of Amnesty International's report with Luciano Del Negro, who's executive director of the Quebec Israel Committee. First, we'll go to the lines, and we'll take Carol from NDG. Carol, good evening. Carol?
Yes.
Good evening.
Hi, Mr. Weissman.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Yourself?
Okay.
Are we on the air right now?
Yes, we are.
Oh, great. There's a group based in Montreal. I don't remember their name very much, but 2 days ago, they denounced the atrocity of Israel. Imagine war crimes. But it's funny that they cannot denounce what's going on for those... this torture in China, I don't understand.
I don't quite understand it myself. There's all these, the tyrannies seem to get away literally with murder, and the left or the progressives seem to excuse them by saying, well, they're developing cultures. They haven't reached our level of sophistication, so they somehow have a right to be wrong. But that's unacceptable. It's not something that we can condone in this society, and thankfully, we have a federal government finally and a federal leadership that is not condoning it. And, Carol, we're just going to discuss that right now with Luciana Del Negro, Executive Director of the Quebec Israel Committee. Luciana, welcome.
Yes, good evening, Beryl. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. This AI report is more of their usual nonsense. How is it possible for these organizations to keep their credibility when they issue one-sided reports and then say, well, we're going to hear the other side later on?
Well, look, Amnesty International, as you know, has a record of disproportionate, one-sided criticism of Israel. It is almost exclusively relies on anecdotal evidence provided by Arab and pro-Arab sources, makes its evidence highly suspect. I mean, imagine, I'm of Italian background, right? Imagine going to see family members of organized criminals, organized crime figures, and asking them, well, is your father, is your brother a member of an organized crime? And they'll say, of course not. He's an honorable person.
But, so but your name ends in a vowel. Luciano, we just got to take a break right now. We'll be right back with you right after this. Or email us at info@iapm.ca. And we're talking with Luciano Del Negro, Executive Director of the Canada Israel Committee, about the Amnesty International report, which, of course, as in its usual knee-jerk, limp-left manner, has castigated Israel. And when AI was asked, well, when are you going to get Israel's views, they said, that's for another report. Luciano, you were starting to talk about some of the myths in this, in the AI approach.
Well, this is not the first time AI has castigated Israel. I mean, based on dubious or fabricated facts gathered by locals with anti-Israel agenda. The example is the myth of the Jenin massacre a few years ago. You all remember where they said there were 1,000 people killed.
Yes.
You know, there has been, you know, the fog of war produces an abundance of myths and of fabricated evidence. The fabricated pictures by the disgraced Reuters photographer is one of them. It is highly, you know, the evidence which is used to implicate Israel is highly suspect.
It's interesting that you bring up Jenin, because I brought up the tapes of Saeb Erekat, who was a member of the Palestinian Authority government, of course, in a CNN interview, 2 weeks apart, and in the second one, of course, in the first one, he talked about the massacre, and the second one, he said, well, okay, I said I would apologize if there really weren't 1,000 dead, and there were about 50, and he went on to apologize. It's a very famous fabrication. And we already know from Nick Robertson, the CNN international correspondent, that they were fabricating stories because they were afraid of Hezbollah. But the one thing that really disturbed me was an AI official using the number, again, the numbers games, of over 1,000 dead in Lebanon. And it was very interesting that at the cessation of hostilities, the Lebanese government said there were some 490 Lebanese who had been killed. A few days after that, Israel announced that over 500 Hezbollah fighters had been killed that they could account for. And about a day after that, the Lebanese government then said, okay, well, now our death toll is over 1,100, and that's the number that AI's commentators accepted.
Well, you know, Beryl, look, certainly one death is one death too many, particularly when that death is a civilian. And, of course, here in Montreal, we are, you know, we've been close to the situation. We've had, you know, compatriots of Lebanese origin who were unfortunately killed. But we all know that the Hezbollah is notorious for using human shields, firing from from positions in villages near homes.
They're proud of it. It's in their propaganda films. They make people stay there at the risk of their lives if they even try to leave.
Right. I mean, you know, the head of the humanitarian section of the United Nations, Mr. Jan Egeland, you know, on the 24th of July 2006, he said that he denounced Hezbollah for using, you know, civilians in a cowardly manner as U.S. shields and being quite proud of the number of civilians who had been killed in their stead. I mean, and again, Mr. Egeland, so I fail to understand how Amnesty International or even after Mr. Egeland afterwards, who sort of criticized the disproportionate reaction of Israel, how, if his first proposition is right, how then can he castigate, or how can anybody castigate Israel? Israel is not the aggressor. Israel does not target civilians. Civilian casualties in Lebanon, of course, is tragic, but they're entirely accidental, unintended collateral damage, and those who are responsible in our own criminal law, if a kidnapper uses a civilian, uses a kidnappee as hostage, and the hostage is accidentally killed by policemen, he is responsible for this crime. And we, you know, argue that this is the same thing. Amnesty International is notorious, unfortunately, for its one-sided criticism of Israel, and it's somewhat rich that for Amnesty International to sort of proceed and in assessing Israel's responsibility when it is well known that the aggressor in this case was certainly Hezbollah.
Amnesty International is engaged in an Alice in Wonderland sentence first, trial after, said the Mad Hatter kind of mentality, and it's not new. Where were they? Where was their sense of outrage when Kosovo's population was being bombed by NATO, or when the Soviets were bombing Chechnya? It seems their cosmic sense of injustice arises only around Israel. But in this case, they openly said, we're not dealing with Israel's position in this report. That's for a second report. That should condemn them in the eyes of any right-thinking person in the world.
Well, you would think that the first people to be scrutinized is the aggressor party. It is the party which instigated the hostilities. The G8, the Security Council's Resolution 1701, calling upon, you know, the ceasefire, also again points the finger at Hezbollah for being responsible. I mean, it's difficult to understand what would prompt Amnesty International, proceed in such a matter unless they had a biased anti-Israeli agenda, as it were. And unfortunately, in this case, it is sad because this organization does valuable work on a number of fronts, and it has sensitized international public opinion on injustices abroad.
But sadly, however, it seems to have a blind spot when it comes to the moral resort area of the Middle East. Luciano Del Negro, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Weisman.
Andy from Cote d'Ivoire.
Yes, Mr. Weisman.
Yes.
Thing is this, Amnesty International, they really burnt my...
Andy, sorry, hold your thought one moment. We got to pay some bills. We'll be right back with you. Now, we're talking about Amnesty International. We were, for the break, we were talking with Andy in Cote d'Ivoire. Andy, you were about to say that AI burns something. Andy?
Burns me up is the way the gentleman was on this morning on radio. And the thing is that they never mentioned, if it would have been both sides would have been looked at, or the Israeli side, the Hezbollah side, the Lebanese side.
No, they specifically
one side,
yeah,
thing.
They specifically said they were not going to listen to the Israeli side. That would be for a separate report.
But the
stunning.
But the worst thing about it is that when NATO bombed Serbia, nothing. When Israel does anything, and in a way acts very humanely, because what enemy force would drop down leaflets saying, please leave the area.
I don't think Russia did that in Chechnya.
Nobody does it. And the thing is this, there's only one thing that irritates, by the way, the first,
and none of the Muslim, the radical Muslims do it in any of their Muslim countries. They've killed more Arab Muslims than they killed anybody else.
Yeah, but there's one thing you have to remember. It is the first impression toward the public that means anything. Even if they bring out a report from the Israeli side, let's say a month or 2 months later, it's going to be like nothing. It has no substance, no meaning.
Well, you know what, Andy? You're right, and to a certain degree. Remember, you know, what Lieutenant Del Negro was talking about, the myth of the Jenin massacre. CNN took the Palestinian Authority, particularly their spokesman, Saeb Erekat, to task, and they said, look, if it's not what you say it is, are you going to apologize? And he came back and apologized, and that made as many headlines as anything else. But you're right, the first impressions matter, and we hope that organizations like Amnesty International start taking their responsibility a little more seriously. And right now, we're welcome Professor Peter March from Halifax, who certainly takes his responsibility seriously as a citizen of a free country. You may recall that we had Professor March on with us during the cartoon controversy, and Professor March, imagine this, had the audacity to actually post those cartoons on his office door. And boy, did he get heat from his university. Professor March, a pleasure to welcome you again.
Good evening.
I understand you're undertaking a lecture tour on Islam and democracy.
Yes, that's correct. We're going to work our way across Canada from Halifax to Vancouver. And the burden of the presentation will be that it's not, in fact, possible for a Muslim to fulfill his or her duties to Islam within Canadian law, and that it's time Canada made that very, very clear from the outset for any Muslim intending to emigrate here.
This, you know, this brings us to an issue that sadly, we've got to look at. Commentators, journalists, correspondents talk about the radical Islam and the Arab street. The vast majority of people are peaceful. But you know what I want to know already? I'm waiting. I want it to be true. I believe it's true. But where is their voice? Where are those marches that condemn the killers?
You're not going to see marches because if you look at the recent evidence, it is that the people prepared to do mass murder, the British and the Canadian case, were people from middle-class homes. So the evidence indicates very clearly now that the so-called extremists are born and bred in so-called non-extremist homes. And the only reasonable surmise to make under these circumstances is that the extreme nature of Islam itself is the problem, so that even if someone is brought up in a so-called moderate home, if they are of a mind to, they can find justification in the writings in the Quran and other places for extremely violent behavior.
Now, many
myself,
would say,
I reject the view that there is a difference between extreme and non-extreme Islam.
Peter,
Islam is extreme.
Many would say that if you took a look at Christian and certainly Hebrew scripture, you would find extreme words there as well. What is the difference? Why? Is it simply the history of religious wars in the West that have brought extremism to an end, or is there something inherently different between the Holy Writ in the Judeo-Christian tradition and Holy Writ in the Islamic tradition?
I think I'm going to argue in the lecture series that certainly our history has been one of vigorous repression of religion so far as involvement in government, or in the judicial process, or in education, or in contracts like marriage. We have made very sure that religion, I'm talking about the West,
yes,
became perhaps a private good, but a public evil. And that tradition of repression has, which I approve of. I use the word repression because that's the natural word to use.
Peter, could you just hold your thought for 1 second? Just let us pay a bill. We'll be right back with you. And we're pleased, Professor Peter March of St. Mary's University in Halifax. You may remember Professor March was a guest with us some months ago during the controversy over the Muhammad cartoons that were printed in Denmark. And Professor March had the courage to post them on his door. in his office, and he is now starting a speaking tour called Islam and Democracy. Peter March, you were making the point before the break that the West now has a tradition of a defined, of a solid defining line between state and faith that is missing in the Islamic world. But the West achieved that after 300 years of religious wars, didn't they not?
Oh, it was a tremendously long period of struggle in which we reined in religion of any kind through, as you say, a series of wars, but also through very, very, very long struggles intellectually, where we extracted religion from public school systems, from universities, etc.
Why has that not happened in the Islamic Arab rim of this planet, let's say from the borders of Pakistan to the Moroccan Atlantic coast?
Well, I think it has to do more with the history of democracy than with the history of religion. It's difficult to know why it is that democracies form such an attraction to the nations north of the Mediterranean and didn't take hold, even though civilization is older in the areas south of the Mediterranean. But for whatever reason, the appearance of democracy in Northern Europe meant that all kinds of restrictions were put on religions for obvious reasons. There's still horrible violations of the treatments of the Jews, obvious case. So the Middle East had theocracy during the long period in which we learned the art of democracy. And the end result is, of course, that in our civilization, the vote of the people, not the vote of the theologians or of the priests, came to have the ascendancy. Thus, the theocracy was not reined in, was not disciplined. They now have a horrible system in which education is pervaded with Islamic instruction, in which I would say the rights of children are horribly violated by forcing them to memorize unhelpful material from the Quran. And not to mention the fact that, of course, the Quran recommends the subjugation of women, and indeed the murder of people for anyone who insults Allah. So they're
state and faith are one. Even without democracy, the basic pillars of constitutional liberalism, and one of which being the separation of state and faith, even those haven't started to be built.
Yes, and I think. I open my talk at the moment with a statement that liberalism, even in Canada now, is in very quick retreat. And the sure sign of that is that freedom of speech is being clamped down on. And I hope that my lecture tour will trigger a visible response from the authorities attempting to stop me saying the things I'm saying, and then we shall have a public discussion about their freedom of speech.
Peter March, if they try that, you've got a lot of friends starting here, and you are one of Canada's most vigorous and most important public intellectuals, and we look forward to hearing more from you. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for calling.
Time for a couple of quick calls. John from Montreal. John? John? Sorry, John. Can't hear you. Let's go to Helen. Helen? Well, we're not having too much luck with the telephone lines tonight, folks. So my apologies to John and Helen. My thanks to all of you listening. The message tonight is your lies begin to end when you stop caring about what really matters. I'm not saying that. Martin Luther King Jr. said that. And what matters is character and conscience and the courage of convictions. And what matters is to live a day as a lion than a lifetime as a lamb. So to JPPS, leave the word Jewish on the building. Never again is more than a slogan about physical survival. It's about spiritual survival. We'll be back with you Monday night. Thanks to Tor Shogren, Master Control. We're out of here.